That was good.
You have caused confusion.
Oh, trashiest moron.
Well, hello everyone. Today I'm going to be looking at a book called The 13th Power, written by Major General Richard Hilson. Now, this book was about the Middle East and the world situation. And Major General Richard Hilson is a writer of some interest to us. He was around just after the Second World War. By the time he wrote this book, he was a retired soldier. He had 35 years of service, 4 years flying in the RFC and the RAF, 2 years in the tank corps, 15 years on the Indian Northwest frontier. He was a military attaché to Moscow in 47-48, and he wrote a number of books. Another very good one is Imperial Obituary, and this one, The 13th Power. I'm going to be reading from the end of it, where he starts talking about one world government, which should be of interest for obvious reasons. I should mention that the 13 powers are, let me just get up the note here, Turkey, Britain, France, Italy, Germany, Austria, and Russia. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Plus the United States, which is 8, Western democracy, 9, something called Afro-Asian democracy, 10, nuclear neurosis, 11, and communism, 12. So what is the 13th power? And this is obviously as it pertains to the Middle East. The 13th power is international finance, working through the United Nations and other devious institutions. So obviously this is of some interest to all of us. This book is incredibly hard to find. If you try to buy it on Amazon, you will come up against this, currently unavailable. There's not even an expensive copy there. Very hard to get hold of. I don't know if there's a PDF out there. I think Imperial Obituary has one, but this one does not. So chances are that what I'm about to read is nowhere else on the internet. So, first of all, let's just play a quick advert to remind you to buy The Trivium. Buy it now. And when I return, we're going to be reading from The 13th Power.
Academic Agency.
All right, so I'm going to be reading from Chapter 16, World Government. I found some old footage of the Middle East from the 1950s to play, so you can watch something as I read. And as ever, if I have something to say, I will interject. So this is Major General Richard Hilton, World Government. It seems time that the British electorate should insist on being told something more definite about this world government to which we are being committed almost without our knowledge. How will it be formed? By what physical force will it be backed? How much independence, if any, will be left to individual states? What safeguard, if any, will there be against a tyrannous misuse of power by an all-powerful world government? These and other pertinent questions ought to be asked in Parliament without delay. Bearing in mind the British electorate's apathy concerning any questions other than social services and the avoidance of war, almost at any cost, It would be optimistic to hope that these questions on world government will be put sufficiently forcibly to obtain anything but evasive answers. Meanwhile, therefore, the only wise course is for thoughtful people to consider the matter for themselves in the light of available evidence. How will world government be formed? I should mention, by the way, I kind of like his blustering, slightly Colonel Blimp, no-nonsense style. I dig Richard Hilton as a writer. Anyway, how will world government be formed? Probably by amending the United Nations Charter, due for renewal shortly, in order to vest the United Nations with greater powers than the organisation possesses at present. There are alternative schemes, such as that of the World Federalists, which we will consider later. By what physical force will it be backed? A recent article dated the 6th of April 1958 in The Observer gives us a clue. The writer suggested that America and Russia might come to an agreement that they, and only they, shall be permitted to possess nuclear armament. The idea is that these giants, widely as they may disagree on other matters, are at least agreed on this one policy, to prevent another world war. They could be trusted, therefore, so the idea develops, to use their combined power to compel one another to keep the peace and forbid another nation to arm itself effectively. This is the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, I believe, which came to be. I mean, it included more than America and Russia, but it did basically come to pass. They would also use their combined power, presumably to coerce any other nation into obeying the dictates of a magnified United Nations or any other form of world government which the wit of man may devise. This suggestion, if adopted, will answer questions 3 and 4 of my second paragraph. No independence will be left to individual states, except in minor matters, which do not run contrary to the wishes of the two giants. There will be no safeguard at all against a tyrannous misuse of this irresistible power by the world government, provided that the two giants agree to back the world government against its victim. The Observer writer disputes this. He feels that there will be a safeguard, and this is how he puts it. This is in the Observer now, in 1958. The rival nature of their political and economic systems must be recognised as an unchangeable fact. The two superpowers could agree on nothing except war prevention. This means that their political differences would make them inherently incapable of setting up any kind of positive dictatorship together. In short, the writer puts forward the thesis that the future of mankind is defenceless subjection under a diarchy of these two superpowers, with the only protection that they could not sink their differences sufficiently to turn the diarchy into a dual dictatorship. Nor, theoretically, need the Polish nation in 1939 have feared that two such irreconcilable ideologies as Nazism and Stalinism could possibly sink their differences sufficiently to combine against their smaller neighbour. One would imagine that the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact should provide mankind with enough warning against ever again trusting to the irreconcilability of theoretically hostile ideologies. After all, there is nothing much in the records either of the Soviet Union or the United States to justify mankind in any childlike faith in the altruism of either. If any reader thinks that this remark is unfair to America, he will do well to consider the one-sided nature of her trade policies. America's exploitation of the most favoured nation clause in commercial treaties, coupled with their own rigid tariff wall, has amounted to an economic war against the British Empire, relentlessly pursued since 1898. Not only against the British Empire has this one-sided interpretation of the most favoured nation clause been exploited, but against every other nation outside the American tariff wall, with a smaller home market than the USA and dependencies. There are strong reasons for the nations to think twice before entrusting their destinies unreservedly into the hands of these two giants. The whole idea is too grimly reminiscent of that sad children's story, The Babes in the Wood. Admittedly, this suggestion in The Observer is so far only the personal prediction of an anonymous writer. It has not yet publicly received any official backing. It is certainly one of the most extreme methods of establishing a world government. The writer himself frankly calls the scheme a diarchy. This could only be done, he admits, by an administrative system drawing its ultimate authority from a diarchy of the two superpowers themselves. In one sense, the Observer article is realistic. It has no false illusions. No matter what form world government takes in theory, the reality of unbridled power will rest with the two giants if they alone are permitted to own nuclear armaments. Keeping this cynical but realistic fact in mind, let us study some of the alternative methods which have been suggested for setting up a world government, commencing with the proposal to employ the existing machinery of the United Nations. In order to render the United Nations to be entrusted with world government, two facelifting operations will have to be performed upon it. It will have to be made absolutely just in its decisions, so just that even the losing party in an international dispute will have no cause whatsoever even to entertain the thought of any miscarriage of justice. The United World, with the various trials, the trials of Milosevic and Saddam Hussein and so on, that went out the window a long time ago, Richard, unfortunately. But his point is correct in principle. The United Nations will have to acquire and deserve a reputation for integrity, like that of the cricket umpires and football referees in the days before sport became debased. I love the fact that he just takes it as read in 1958 that sport has become debased. I wonder what he's got in mind. I mean, we would think back to the 1950s as when sport had integrity, but he thinks it had already become debased anyway. In this respect, it has already a very long way to go. During its short life, the United Nations' reputation for fearless dispensation of justice cannot be called good. We have witnessed the United Nations' handling of the Kashmir dispute, the Suez Canal Company's case versus NASA, and the Suez incident which followed, the United Nations' handling of the Hungarian Rising is also instructive. So is its handling of the Netherlands' complaint against Indonesia for spoliation and ill treatment of Dutch residents. In the case of Kashmir, a blind eye has been turned to Mr. Nehru's contemptuous defiance of the United Nations' feeble protests and recommendations. NASA still holds the company's stolen property, for which the company had to wait until April 1958 for redress. The Suez incident itself is perhaps the most instructive of all the United Nations exploits. Israel, after suffering for 7 years from the blockade of her shipping, attacked Egypt, who had been enforcing this blockade by arms. Egypt, having been justifying this action by claiming to be still at war with Israel. Egypt's use of armed force for 7 years drew only ineffective admonitions from the United Nations, whereas Israel's use of force to this end in the 7 years war, as Egypt itself has called it, has at once met by the severe censure of the United Nations, coupled with dire threats. This can hardly be called impartiality. I'm sure some pro-Israeli viewers may be thinking, the more things change, the more they stay the same, because the United Nations, even today, is not a big fan of Israel. The United Nations' treatment of the Anglo-French operation can best be studied concurrently with the United Nations reaction to Budapest. Britain and France, after waiting for July till the end of October for some action to be taken by the United Nations, took the matter into their own hands. This action was condemned by the United Nations, whether justly or unjustly, is still controversial. It is also immaterial that the two great powers obeyed the ruling of the United Nations. At about the same time, Russia used armed force to suppress a popular uprising in Budapest, the capital of a sovereign independent country, theoretically at any rate, and a member of the United Nations. This action by Russia shocked the conscience of humanity, including even the consciences of many ardent communists. The United Nations' reaction to this at the time was precisely nil. Hilton is highlighting one of the central principles of elite theory as laid out in my book, The Populist Delusion. Buy it now, everybody. That there are basically no, where there is power, there are no neutral institutions. This is the point that I think he's driving towards here. And the two giants, Russia and America, basically can't be trusted to be impartial in these sorts of matters. And the Budapest situation, where there was a violent crackdown on an uprising, is a case in point. The world has learned from these incidents that the United Nations is effective against nations which obey their obligation to respect its rulings, but not against those who flout them. It is kind to Afro-Asian demagogues, but become relied upon to condemn the colonial powers every time. Above all, it is unthinkable that the United Nations ever say boo to Russia or America, no matter where, how, or why they use armed force. It is worth noting that America, who had played the leading part in the condemnation of the Anglo-French quote-unquote aggression, sent her Sixth Fleet only a few months later to intimidate Syria. Again, friends, the more things change, the more they stay the same. The United Nations kept discreetly quiet about this. It is true that the Sixth Fleet did not actually open fire. It did not need to. But if this was not an aggressive use of armed force, there is no meaning in words. Incidentally, what is armed aggression in the eyes of the United Nations? When NASA stole the Suez Company's property, he sent armed soldiers into the Port Said offices. Was this an employment of armed force or not? It appears to depend on who is the user of force. The United Nations' ideas of justice are simply not good enough for world government. It is hard to see how this can be remedied without destroying the United Nations entirely and rebuilding something which is not financially dependent on America and not afraid of Russia or of starting a nuclear war. Finally, the revised organization must be something which is not so constituted that the older civilizations of Europe can be outvoted by the Afro-Asian bloc, the dollar bloc, and the Soviet bloc. It is a tall order, but there is no other way of ensuring international justice. If the United Nations has to rely upon the two giants, Russia and America, to act as policemen and enforce its decrees, then it will become merely a figurehead. The reality of power will rest with the giants, and they will rule the world. Well, no shit, Sherlock. That is indeed what happened. To render the United Nations effective as a world government, quite apart from the problem of rendering it a fountain of true justice, it will have to be endowed with sufficient and armed might to keep even the two giants subservient to its decrees. Ha ha! Well, that didn't happen, did it? If anyone imagines that either Russia or America is likely to agree to this, he is rather optimistic. Yes, indeed. Russia will not submit herself, disarmed, to any world government unless it is communist-dominated. Well, even since communism, we've seen that that is still true of Russia, even under Putin. America will not consent to any change in the Constitution of the United Nations which will make that organisation immune from dollar pressure. And you can double underline that, triple underline it, and send it to the bank, because that has been true from 1958 to the present day. In any case, nobody yet has squarely faced the problem of so reconstituting the United Nations as to render it fairly representative of all the nations in proportion to their standing in the world. Let us suppose, for example, that some scheme could be devised whereby Salvador, or any other miniature country, could be rendered sufficiently free of dollar pressure to be truly as important in voting as any other member. This might perhaps be achieved by introducing secrecy of ballot in the General Assembly and by abolishing the privileged position of the great powers in the Security Council. The effect of any such measures would be to put the United States on exact equality with Monaco, Liberia, Albania, and some other miniature states. She would, we have assumed, already have surrendered her nuclear power into the hands of the superstate, the world government. If she followed this by surrendering the power of veto, also, and abrogated her financial power over other states, she would have no greater say in world affairs than the tiny states just mentioned. It is absurd even to imagine such a surrender of power by America or Russia. Well, of course, they're never going to do that in a million years, which is the point that Hilton is making. Certain schools of thought, such as the World Federalists, have already foreseen the impossibility of building any world government other than a concert of the great powers upon voting by nations. The World Federalists, therefore, advocate a world government founded upon universal adult suffrage by individuals, not by nations. A moment's thought shows the absurdity of this proposition also. It is estimated that about one-third of the human race is under communist rule. The most elementary knowledge of communist electoral methods tells us that one-third of mankind will vote exactly as their communist rulers wish them to vote. If we add to this huge block of regimented votes, it would add to this huge block of regimented votes the communist parties of the free world and their dupes and fellow travellers, it can be seen that communism will not go far to go before obtaining the majority of individual votes throughout the world. Apart from this danger, the Federalist idea would endow a Central African savage. Hoo-hoo! Getting spicy, Richard. A Central African savage. Bear in mind, listeners, this was written in 1958. With an equal say in world affairs to the wisest men that civilization can produce. And this would surely be democracy run mad. Well, what would Richard Hilton say if I could transport him to a modern city in Britain or America today? What if I took him to Springfield, Ohio? Or if I took him just down to some of the streets where certain communities, quote-unquote, live in London? I mean, I think Major General Richard Hilton would... he'd have a fit, wouldn't he, basically? But anyway, this is where we are. Many Federalists appear already to have realised this. A large number of schemes have been considered for tempering the absurdity of universal suffrage by one form or another of selective qualifications for voting power. All of these beg the vital question: what authority will decide upon this differential scale of electors? It is hard to imagine even the most primitive of the newly independent Afro-Asian nations willingly admitting that its citizens are inferior man for man to those of any of the hated Western ex-imperialist states. The scale of electoral qualifications would have to be arbitrarily fixed by some sort of committee, and then it must be imposed by force. Who will be represented on the committee, and who will wield such force? You can see why I like this, friends, because Hilton is playing with the absolute rules of power here. He is drawing attention to those elite theory principles that I have talked about time and again in a completely matter-of-fact and realist way when dealing with this problem. There's still quite a bit of this to go, and if we go long, so be it. In short, nobody yet has been able to propound a scheme for the creation of a world government which will stand the test of practical examination. World government must either be one thing or the other. It will either be a talking shop for demagogues from the overpopulated primitive countries with a sprinkling of quote-unquote stooges from the communist lands, or else a shadow government with no real power, directed and controlled by arbitrary power behind the scenes. The former alternative means anarchy and chaos. The latter, far more probable, will mean world dictatorship by the oligarchy that pulls the strings of money power. And now we're getting somewhere. Hopefully you've been bearing with me. Amid the persistent and frequently vociferous propaganda in favour of world government, there is a strange silence about these practical difficulties in the vaunted scheme. Not so strange, perhaps, if we understand that this propaganda is inspired and financed and directed by people who know perfectly well in whose hands this immense power will lie when once mankind has been fooled into the trap. They have got their plans neatly worked out, these small groups of dominant men. It is not even so very strange that mankind is swallowing the idea of world government without bothering to inquire how it is going to be made safe for democracy, quote unquote. The two-shot ambush has worked only too well. Mankind has had its nerves so lacerated by the bogey of communism and the bogey of nuclear war that it is prepared to ignore the tyranny which lies hidden behind those apparently blessed words, world government. On the 10th of June 1958, Mr. Sandys, the Minister of Defence, in a debate on disarmament, propounded some illuminating ideas on what he called disarmament in a single step. After dwelling on the practical difficulties of disarmament by stages, due to Soviet antagonism toward any effective system of inspection, Mr. Sandys envisaged the possibility of establishing a world security authority, which would be armed with two instruments, namely an international arms inspectorate and an international police force. Though he emphasised that these ideas were in no sense formal proposals, the mere fact of their utterance by a statesman of his standing may presumably be taken as an indication of the train of thought which is favoured in British governmental circles, particularly as it tends to corroborate something said by a less prominent member of the government in November 1957. Mr. Sandys envisaged for his proposed inspectorate a right of completely unrestricted access to any premise in any country. The proposed police force would have to possess unquestioned military superiority over the disarmed nations. There would be every advantage, Mr. Sandys claimed, in basing such a plan upon the principles embodied in the United Nations Charter. When suggestions of this nature are publicly made by a Minister of State, no matter how informally, the British nation should realise that world government may be much more imminent than is generally supposed. Richard, mate, if you think the British public are ever going to wake up, they're never going to wake up. And that it will involve surrender of our national independence in subjection to an alien authority backed by irresistible military power. In the debate which followed the minister's speech, members of all three parties made it clear that the implication behind Mr. Sandy's words was indeed no less than this. Mr. Clement Davis, the former Liberal leader, said, for example, that the day had been made memorable by Mr. Sandy's speech. It was the first time, said Mr. Clement Davis, that a government had made a declaration to the world that they were prepared, in the interests of universal peace, to surrender their sovereignty. Is British public opinion equally awake to the tremendous significance of the plans for the abolition of our national freedom, which are passing through the minds of our political leaders? Is British public opinion so satisfied with the bona fides and the impeccable justice of the United Nations that it will happily hand over to that authority a control of our national liberties which former British generations have defended with their lives against would-be rulers of the world? Nuclear neurosis must indeed have numbed the senses of the British people if they are fully awake to the import of Sandy's speech, and yet are ready to swallow its consequences without a qualm. Well, you'd be surprised what else they were prepared to swallow, Major General Richard Hilton, because, my gosh, if you could be here now, what you would say, what you would see. No insuperable obstacle exists against the establishment of a common policy between the oligarchies of the Kremlin and of Wall Street. Those who imagine that one stands for the abolition of capitalism and the other for its retention are out of date. At one time, the Russian Communist Party may have consisted of idealists who believed in theoretical Marxism, but that has long ceased to be true. High-souled idealists of Marxism were among the first victims of the purges of 1937 and later. Present rulers of Russia are hard-boiled realists who believe in nothing but the state capitalism which they helped to build and which is based on police tyranny. The manipulators of money power in Wall Street likewise believe in a state capitalism based in their case upon a dollar tyranny. The methods may be different, but the final result will be the same. World government, no matter on what basis it is erected, can be nothing but world tyranny. The only feasible road to it at present is through some form of diarchy by the United States and the Soviet Union. Well, we saw what happened, Major General, when that diarchy was broken after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the world did indeed fall under American hegemony. And hark what discord followed. Anyway, let's continue. All other nations having surrendered their powers of independent life, the idea that these two nations could ever collaborate to tyrannize mankind is dangerous optimism. For at the back of both of these superstates stand the 13th power, the international money power. And that is the end of the chapter. Now, I don't know if I will read any beyond this, but he does have a final chapter, the 17th chapter of the book, called Our British Task. And I think what I'll do is I will just read the opening paragraph of that, to see what he was proposing to do in 1958. Obviously, none of this came to pass. Nobody listened to him. But it is interesting that there were still people, you know, who had been fairly high up in the British military talking in this way in 1958. So this is our British task. When once mankind is committed to world government, there will be no way out. Already it has become impossible for nations outside the Iron Curtain to extricate themselves from GATT, that is the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and all other strangleholds which dollar diplomacy has fastened upon the once economically free world. Today you'd think of NAFTA, various trade agreements, the European Union, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Those who have a bent for political economy are strongly recommended to read The Uncertain Ally by Mr. John Biggs Davison, MP. My copy is already in the post, friends, because I foresaw a rush on that book when I knew I was going to make this video. I've already got my copy of Uncertain Ally. You can get yours now. Where the American economic intrigues against the British Empire and against the civilizations of Western Europe have been candidly disclosed. The principle of non-discrimination in trade, which sounds so benign and fair, is in effect simply a device for ensuring that the huge American economy, protected by its own tariff wall, can thrust its way into all other markets, flood them with its products, often to the extent of forcing upon the unwilling recipients American goods, which they do not want and cannot afford to buy, and thus perpetuate and increase the indebtedness of other nations to the American economy, through it to the money power which rules from New York. Simultaneously, beyond the Iron Curtain, the rest of mankind is being regimented into another pen. Here, the stick which drives them is not the dollar, but the police truncheon. But the ultimate result will be much the same. In the one case, the dollar-run state capitalism, and in the other, the police-run state capitalism. In both cases, a mongrelized humanity on a strictly rationed living standard will work in a godless human ant heap for two sets of bosses, who in turn will act as bailiffs for the real bosses, the international money-lending oligarchy. Any notion that world government will be by consent of the governed is simply absurd. This may sound like George Orwell's 1984. Unfortunately, it may be much nearer than that. There is only one escape from this horror: to back out before it's too late. Swift and vigorous action will be needed to break free from the economic chains which are already fastened on the so-called free world. There is only one community which can give lead to the ensnared nations, just as we have given lead 5 times already in the last 400 years to nations striving against a would-be world conqueror. The British Empire, or what is left of it, or family of nations, for those who prefer the modern jargon, must give this lead. Our task may appear insuperable, but so it did on the former occasions. Insuperable or not, it has got to be achieved, and it will be achieved if we pull ourselves together. There is no time to lose. Every passing week renders a comeback more difficult. Let us examine our assets and liabilities, our points of strength and weakness, before suggesting a line of action. And I'm going to stop reading there, because obviously this plan of his did not come to fruition. The British Empire did not lead the charge against the international money power. And indeed, now in 2024, it does appear that it is far, far too late for that. For the might and strength of the British Empire is well and truly gone, as Hilton demonstrates in his other book, The Imperial Obituary. But I hope you can see why I read you that, because there were people who were onto them, who understood what was happening, even back in the 50s. And it is, I still think there are ways of thinking here that could be of benefit to us. So I wanted to make this available to everybody today. That'll do for now. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.